The Guardian.
Stephen Hawking, the brightest star in the firmament of science, whose insights shaped modern cosmology and inspired global audiences in the millions, has died aged 76. Last year, The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample recorded a special edition of Science Weekly, which marked Hawking's 75th birthday. The program, as you'd expect, is a joyous celebration of Stephen's life and work.
And now, on with the show.
Luck. Well, we have been very lucky. I mean, my family and Stephen and everybody, you have your disasters, but the point is that we have survived. Everybody has disasters, and yet some people disappear and are never seen again.
On the 8th of January 1942, Frank and Isabel Hawking celebrated the birth of their son, Stephen. 75 years later, and Professor Stephen Hawking is one of the most prominent scientists of all time. In a career spanning half a century, the cosmologist has notched up more than 150 scientific papers, a dozen or so books, and a string of TV and film appearances. The achievement is all the more remarkable for his diagnosis at the age of 21 with motor neurone disease.
The theoretical physicist, cosmologist, and author is one of the preeminent scientists of his generation, as well as numerous scientists.
What has Stephen Hawking done for science and other areas of life? In this special birthday edition, we ask physicists, many of whom have worked with Hawking, about his contributions to science and the wider world. In doing so, we celebrate Stephen Hawking, the scientist, and Stephen Hawking, the man.
We were discussing the possibility of the spontaneous generation of life.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
That Stephen made a remark which indicated not only that he thought of this, but he'd even also come across some calculations as to how long it might take.
Stephen Hawking has shaped our view of the cosmos. His work has touched on the origin of the universe, the distribution of galaxies, and of course, the nature of black holes.
Hello.
At the heart of every black hole is an infinitesimal dot, a point in space known as a singularity. Here, gravity's pull is so intense that not even light can escape. And this is where our brief history begins. As explained by Hawking's collaborator and longtime friend, Sir Roger Penrose at Oxford University.
It was in the early 1960s when the Dutch astronomer Martin Schmidt had discovered what we now call quasars. These are objects which are extraordinarily bright and extraordinarily distant. So they're brighter than a galaxy, but seem to be very small. Compared with the galaxy, this would be about the size of the solar system. And these objects were very puzzling because they seemed to indicate that there would be very concentrated gravitational fields, meaning that the mass of the whatever it was would be so small that it would be about the size of what's called the Schwarzschild radius. Now that means that what we now call a black hole would be something like this kind of scale. Now, the idea of a black hole had been just before the war, in I think 1939, there was a paper by Oppenheimer and Snyder, one of his students, and they studied the collapse of material to what we now call a black hole. And it seemed that maybe something of the kind of this object that the Oppenheimer and Snyder had studied might be actually present in the universe, which was a great surprise to people because although people knew about this radius where if you squashed material down to that scale, something funny would happen, we didn't sort of believe that you'd actually find things like this in the universe. So that was around, I can't remember exactly the dates of this, it was around 1963, 1964. And John Wheeler, I remember, was very worried about these things because according to the work by Oppenheimer and Snyder, you would get this collapse to what's called a singularity, so that the matter would become infinite density and the space-time curvatures would become infinite. There were two things about the Oppenheimer-Snyder solution which you might think were unrealistic. One was that the matter was a very idealized material which didn't have any pressure, so as the body collapsed, there was nothing to push it apart. The other was, more importantly, was that the thing had to be spherically symmetrical. So everything was, as it fell in, would be focused at this one central point. And if densities become infinite at that central point, it's perhaps not surprising because there's nothing to stop this matter as it falls in. So although Oppenheimer and Stein had this example of what we would now call a black hole, there was a lot of reason to be doubtful about this. And Wheeler was, as I say, worrying about, you know, are these singularities real or are they an artifact of these particular very symmetrical collapses?
By taking a different approach to many in the field, Roger formulated the first modern theory of singularities in a 1965 paper entitled Gravitational Collapse and Space-Time Singularities. It showed that black holes and the singularities they contained were very much a possibility in our universe. And it was through this work that Roger first came into contact with a young Stephen Hawking.
Now, the first time I met Stephen was after I gave this talk in Cambridge on my singularity theorem about black holes. And he was the first time he'd really heard of these arguments. And I had quite a long discussion with him and with George Ellis, with whom he'd been working. And Stephen took on board the things I was saying. And you see, my arguments had to do with a local collapse. You had an object which was a collection of stars or something could collapse together, whatever it might be. But this was a reasonably local thing. But what Stephen realized, you could use the same sort of argument on a cosmological scale. So he was able to show in his first theorem, basically, that the singularity theorem that I had proved could be used to talk about the Big Bang singularity as opposed to the localized singularities of gravitational collapse, the black hole singularities.
Working together, Stephen and Roger went on to co-author a number of papers in the 60s and 70s describing their various singularity theorems, but they didn't always agree with one another.
There were these lectures in Cambridge that became a Princeton publication called The Nature of Space and Time, where we gave alternate lectures. And I wanted to talk to Stephen about something. And it was a bit difficult to get to talk to him because I think, if you may say so, it was The Guardian that were talking to Stephen. So when they'd finished, and I went in to talk to Stephen. And then when I finished talking to Stephen, I came out and I saw this chap sitting in the chair just outside the door. And he said, "Excuse me, can I ask you a question?" I said, "That's fine." He said, "Stephen has set this problem to me where I'm supposed to show that something you did is wrong. Could you explain what he was saying?" So I had to talk to the student to try and explain what he was supposed to do to show that I was wrong.
Following his work on singularities, Hawking turned his attention to more general black hole physics.
Hello.
Here he came up against the proposal that black holes have no hair.
Which kind of star it was formed from?
As explained by Marika Taylor, a former student of Hawking's and now professor of physics at the University of Southampton.
So a black hole is said to have no hair if we can describe that black hole just by knowing how heavy it is, what its mass is, and how much it's spinning. So a normal star that we see in the sky, something like the sun, it's not enough just to tell you how heavy it is and how much it's spinning. We have to give you a lot more information to know exactly what's going on in that star. But black holes seem to be very special. You seem to know everything about them with knowing just the mass and the spin. So we say it has no hair.
And because it has no hair, we can't keep track of what falls into a black hole.
So if I throw my obsolete computer into a black hole, if I throw my obsolete textbooks into a black hole, the only way that the black hole seems to keep track of what fell into it is by how heavy it is and how much it spins. Now, you could think that maybe the black hole was hiding deep inside the information about what fell in. So deep inside, it knows that a computer fell in or a textbook fell in. But Stephen Hawking showed that black holes just evaporate into a bath of radiation. And that radiation, again, doesn't seem to know anything about what fell into the black hole during its lifetime.
This leads to what is known as the black hole information paradox.
The black hole information paradox is a puzzle that you get from trying to combine quantum mechanics with gravity. I mean, it's usually assumed in science that if you know information about a system at one point in time, you'll be able to work out, at least in principle, what happens at any other time. But Stephen Hawking's calculations in the 1970s suggested that information was actually disappearing in a black hole. That meant that you wouldn't be able to work out what happened at a later time, even if you knew all the information about the black hole at any given time.
We'll return to this paradox a little later on, but as Marika mentioned, the paradox itself came about from a prediction Hawking made in 1974 of what would later be known as Hawking radiation.
Hello?
This is Sabine Hossenfelder.
So I'm Sabine Hossenfelder, and I'm a research fellow at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies. I work mainly on quantum gravity and physics beyond the Standard Model. a bottle of Coke.
I spoke to Sabine via Skype and started by asking her how Hawking thought black holes might radiate heat and eventually evaporate altogether.
Well, he was trying to combine quantum field theory, so that's the mathematics that the Standard Model is built off, with classical gravity. So general relativity is a non-quantum interaction, in contrast to the other interactions in the Standard Model. And if you combine them, strange things can happen. So this area is known as quantum field theory in curved space-time. And the mathematics is fairly straightforward if you know both areas. But it was something that in the early and mid-70s, not many people had done. So what Hawking did was he put these quantum fields into the curved geometry of a black hole and just looked what happened. And he found that, quite counterintuitively, the black hole would emit radiation, which is now known as Hawking radiation.
But how does this Hawking radiation come about?
The picture that Hawking himself has popularized is that there are pairs of particles, so-called virtual particles. They are in a quantum vacuum. They are constantly created and annihilate again. And if the background is curved, they can be torn apart so that one part of the pair escapes to infinity, can be measured, and the other one falls in. So that's a quite popular picture. It has various shortcomings that don't match with the mathematics. For example, it suggests very strongly that the particles are located somewhere nearby the horizon. And if you look at the math, that's actually not the case. So these particles are quite blurry. They are spread out over a fairly large distance. So, you know, the picture is not wrong, but you shouldn't think of the particles as points, more like fluffy clouds or something that get torn apart and one part falls in and the other one escapes.
And you say that that's the mechanism that Hawking has popularized. Is that fairly well accepted by the community, or is it a minority view?
Well, the result of the calculation is accepted by pretty much everyone. I don't think I've ever met anyone who actually doubts this. As I said, it's a pretty straightforward calculation if you know both quantum field theory and general relativity. So if you're asking, does everybody agree with this picture that Hawking has generated with the particle pairs that are being ripped apart, are people happy with that picture? Well, I'm not happy with it because I think it's misleading. If people get all kinds of confusions about how exactly this happens. The first question, and I've gotten this question like dozens of times, is how does the mass of the black hole shrink if a particle falls in? How is that supposed to work? And that's kind of an obvious question. And so what happens is, if you look at the math, is that the energy of the infalling particle is actually negative. Okay, so that's the next question. Well, what the heck is a particle with a negative energy? And so if you look at the math, it's pretty obvious what happens. It's that you have a background that can't change. So you cannot create energy out of nothing. That doesn't work. The only way that you can create this pair of particles is if one part has a positive energy and the other one has a negative energy. And then the one with the positive energy escapes and the one with the negative energy falls in. And then it makes sense that the black hole's mass shrinks. So that's why this interpretation with the particle pairs that are being produced can be quite misleading and leads to confusions that you do not have if you look at the math.
Whether or not the theory is accepted, is there any experimental evidence for it? Unfortunately for us, the time it takes some of these black holes to evaporate, and we're talking billions of years, makes it nigh on impossible to measure the process. That said, as explained by Sabine, a relatively new field here on Earth might provide some backing for Hawking radiation.
It's known as analog gravity, because these are analogs to gravity. And these analogies are certain kinds of condensed matter system, typically some kind of a fluid. So the analogy there is that in the fluid, you don't have light that propagates as you would have in the environment of a black hole. Well, it's called black because it eats up all the light. So in this condensed matter system, it's not the light that is relevant, but it's the sound that propagates in this background. So sound is basically a density fluctuation. And in these backgrounds, you can have acoustic horizons in the same way that you have these light horizons for black holes out there in space. So you can have certain types of fluids where you have a region that traps the sound waves. And the amazing thing is that if you look at the mathematics, it's exactly the same math as the math that you get for the Hawking effect in the curved background of a black hole. And from this, you can conclude that also for these analog black holes that are based on these fluids, you should also see something like Hawking radiation. And so there's a few months ago, there has been a paper published by Jeff Steinhauer, who claims that he has actually measured the Hawking radiation. So he is using in particular Bose-Einstein condensates of certain types of atoms.
And these are very cold condensates of atoms.
Yes, they are very cold and they are superfluid. That has the benefit that the viscosity is very low. And that's important because this analogy between the gravitational system and the condensed matter system, strictly speaking, only works if there's no viscosity. But if you get it small enough, that's that works pretty well. And well, he claims he has measured it. And I find this totally amazing.
Do you believe it?
Well, I'm not an experimentalist. And for me, it's really hard to see how you can measure that, how large are the uncertainty, is it reasonable that you can pick out the signal from what is the noisy system. So I heard a talk from him and it seems to me solid research. But I also know that there have been people who have criticized it, who have said that it's not clear that the fluctuation that he sees there are actually the Hawking particles, but that these are classical fluctuations. So I think the summary is that it's not entirely settled if he's actually seen what he claims to have seen. But I think sooner or later they'll figure it out and they will probably see it. You know, it might take some more while until they fully understand the system and all the observables and all the noise and so on. But sooner or later, they'll manage to do it.
So, progress of sorts in our efforts to understand Hawking radiation. After this short break, we'll hear whether the same can be said for the black hole information paradox we mentioned earlier.
The black hole information paradox remains a paradox today. But since the 1990s, most scientists have believed that Hawking's conclusion from the 1970s wasn't correct. They believe that information is preserved by black holes. But we don't really understand completely how that information is preserved.
And we'll also hear how Stephen turned his attention to the evolution of the universe and the birth of galaxies.
You can't have a Big Bang with inflation just creating a boring universe that's the same everywhere. Instead, you get this Hawking radiation, these ripples in the very fabric of space-time that mess things up a little bit.
We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Jason Phipps here, ruler of all things podcast here at The Guardian. Just to let you know that this episode is sponsored by the good people at Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Before we kick off again, I wanted to recommend another one of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Audio Long Reads and contains some of The Guardian's best journalism in the form of long read articles from the paper. Recent long reads include Wendell Stevenson's piece on Syria's disappearing food culture, and Ewan McCaskill and Jonathan Franklin's portrait of Roberto Kozak, Latin America's Schindler. To subscribe to Audio Long Reads, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard about a handful of Stephen Hawking's most prominent scientific endeavours, including the black hole information paradox and Hawking radiation. It was a journey that started with singularities, with Hawking showing similarities between those found at the centre of black holes and those at the beginning of the universe.
That's coming back to me now.
In the 1980s, Hawking went on to apply his thinking to the Big Bang and the subsequent creation of galaxies.
Good morning, Ian.
This is Max Tegmark.
Yeah, I'm Max Tegmark, a physics professor at MIT.
I spoke to Max via Skype and started by asking him what we really mean by the Big Bang.
The most successful theory we have for what put the bang into our Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago is inflation. And it says that our universe grew just like we did when we were babies. We kept doubling at regular intervals. We were one cell, two cells, four cells, eight, 16, and so on. And our universe similarly kept doubling its size, but in much more rapid succession, until a tiny speck much smaller than an atom became much larger than everything we can see around us today with our telescopes. And during this violent doubling process, there was an event horizon. There was a region around where we are now, beyond which we could not see. Light from there couldn't reach us because space was just expanding way, way too fast. And Stephen realized that that's exactly analogous to when you have a black hole, except that in the black hole case, light can't come out from it. In this case, in cosmology, light can't come into it. So Stephen thought to himself, hey, in a black hole, when you have an event horizon, you get this Hawking radiation, you get fluctuations. You can't just have things perfectly symmetric and uniform. There must be ripples in things. There must be ripples in, for example, in the magnetic field and other things causing light and other stuff to come out of that hole to make it evaporate. So Stephen realized that the same thing should be happening in our baby universe. There should be ripples in the magnetic field and everything. And in particular, Stephen realized there should even be ripples in the very fabric of space-time itself. And that has a really dramatic prediction that wasn't testable at the time, but that I and many others have worked on testing since, which is that inflation doesn't just predict a vast amount of stuff that's flying apart uniformly and orderly. It actually messes things up a little bit. It puts a little bit more stuff in some places than other places, so that over the billions of years that follow, what happens is that these tiny, tiny seed fluctuations, these Hawking fluctuations, actually grow into galaxies and all the other large-scale structure we see around us today. So according to Stephen Hawking's prediction, today, the reason we have life in our universe in the first place actually goes back to these quantum effects that happened during the first moments of our universe. It's one of the most beautiful ideas in the history of science, in my opinion.
So that's the theory, but is there any evidence to back it up?
Yes, there is, because when you go through the math, you predict that these ripples should have a very, very special structure. You can take precision photos, for example, of our baby universe in the microwave background to see what it looked like just 400,000 years after our Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago. And you can make predictions for how many big splotches there should be in those maps compared to how many small splotches there should be. And it's been a real honor for me to get to work with many of my experimental collaborators over the years to analyze these measurements in great detail. And they agree spectacularly with the predictions that were made by Stephen Hawking and others way back using this Hawking mechanism.
It seems that Hawking's theories of radiation and the evolution of the early universe are pretty well accepted. But when it comes to the information paradox, there is still plenty up for debate. Marika Taylor again.
The black hole information paradox remains a paradox today. But since the 1990s, most scientists have believed that Hawking's conclusion from the 1970s wasn't correct. They believe that information is preserved by black holes. But we don't really understand completely how that information is preserved.
One such theory that Marika champions is known as the holographic principle.
So holography suggests that gravity itself can be described by a theory in one less dimension which has no type of gravity. And the holographic principle suggests that the event horizon of the black hole is actually keeping track of what falls into the black hole. And then when the black hole evaporates into radiation, that information will be carefully encoded in the radiation that comes out.
So should we think of it as a kind of a shell around the black hole which stores this information, which is almost this region where the hologram occurs? Or is the holographic sort of aspect throughout the body of the black hole, if that makes sense?
Well, again, it's very much a debate what the behavior of the black hole is close to the event horizon. We understand now that quantum effects are quite important. Many people think that effectively the black hole event horizon itself behaves almost like a giant computer hard disk, a giant quantum computer. And it might not even make sense in that context to think about an inside of the black hole at all. There may not be a space-time description there at all. Quantum physics might be so strong that the notion of space-time doesn't exist. But these ideas are still very much being explored, so we don't have definitive answers yet.
But is there some kind of mathematical support and some kind of convincing mathematical support for that holographic idea? Or is it just a more convenient hope, if you like, to get around this hard problem?
So the holographic principle itself and the holographic idea is supported by tens of thousands of research papers doing very, very precise calculations. So this is an idea which is very much believed by theoretical physicists, mathematicians. The implications for black holes are still under exploration.
Is there a chance we'll ever be able to see this information on the black hole?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's certainly something that people are thinking about right now. While most scientists are convinced that information is preserved in black holes and that holograms are an important component of how the information is preserved, we really don't understand exactly how the black holes have hair keeping track of what goes in. We know that something is happening around the event horizon, but we don't know exactly what. So there's a lot of ongoing research. Stephen himself is extremely active in this, in trying to understand what the nature of the black hole hair is, and also whether we would be able to see it with a LIGO gravitational wave detector or any of the other telescopes which are looking at black holes.
And even though much of this black hole talk can seem somewhat esoteric at times, Marika points out that the potential ramifications of Stephen's work on black holes are far-reaching.
Well, black holes are one place where we know that we really have to understand how quantum mechanics is reconciled with gravity. And the other place where we really know that quantum mechanics plays an important role is at the very beginning of the universe. So understanding black holes better may help us to understand the beginning of the universe better. It may help us to understand the question of what is the dark energy that's driving the acceleration of the universe. Beyond that, black holes seem to be very deeply related to quantum computers. Black holes are perhaps the best quantum computers that exist in nature. And so studying black holes may actually help us to understand how a quantum computer would function. And in fact, some organizations like Intel are actually financing some of this research because they hope it will actually help them understand quantum computing.
Throughout the interviews with Stephen's students and collaborators, I found myself wanting to know not just about the physics, but the person too.
I think you've already covered.
What is Stephen Hawking like as a supervisor, for example?
Well, Stephen is extremely committed to his research. He always found time for his PhD students. He was always happy to talk. he really liked to understand the details of the calculations that we were doing. He has an enormous sense of humor. He would make jokes all the time. One of my favorite jokes was when we were sitting in a pub one day discussing our research, and he started typing something on his speech synthesizer. And then I noticed that he was turning up the volume to make it really, really loud. And I thought, why is he doing this? And then he made it really loud and said, "I'm coming out." And the whole of the pub turned around and looked at us. And then he sort of turned the volume down and said, "I'm coming out and admitting that maybe information loss doesn't occur. You know, we should sort of think about this." But of course, the whole of the pub turned around thinking he meant something entirely different. And he had a mischievous sort of chuckle at what he was doing.
The wicked sense of humour, as well as a real dedication to his work and students, was something mentioned by all of our contributors.
The theoretical physicist, cosmologist and author is one of the preeminent scientists of his generation. As well as numerous scientific awards, he has penetrated the fabric of popular culture with his appearances on television and in film.
And it wasn't just the world of science that felt the full force of Stephen Hawking's work. Sabine again.
The remarkable thing about his first book was just that he had the courage to take on this topic, which was and still is fairly abstract and detached from everyday life. And I think nobody at this time would have expected that there are so many people who are interested in learning about these things. And if you look at the popular science press in physics now, it looks totally different than from what I did 30 years ago. It's like everybody wants to know about black holes. What do the black holes do? Everybody knows something about the black hole information loss problem. People talk about the Big Bang over dinner. And I find it remarkable how much the popular science media has changed in these 30 years. And I think that in the area of theoretical physics in particular, Hawking has played a large role in this.
And with over 10 million copies of A Brief History of Time sold worldwide, it's hard to argue against this.
Despite all these accomplishments, he's still best known for his book, A Brief History of Time.
But whether it's Stephen Hawking the scientist, Stephen Hawking the communicator, or Stephen Hawking the man, it's impossible to deny the impact he has had.
Apart from his skills, his mathematical skills, his understanding of physics, his geometrical skills, all these things are very pronounced in him. He had tremendous ability, and he was very quick at understanding ideas. That's true too. But I think the main thing that comes across is his absolute determination not to let anything get in his way. Somehow, the fact that he had this physical disability, in a way, it was what focused his attention. He thought he didn't have long to live. He just had two or three years, probably. And he really wanted to get as much he could get done at that time, and absolute tremendous determination.
Well, his contributions to the fields of cosmology and black hole physics have been enormous. So he's brought up a lot of new lines of thinking, and I think that especially with the black hole evaporation, it has opened basically an entirely new line of research. So it's not so well known, but black hole physics is kind of an area of research, and it brings together a lot of different areas of physics. That's the exciting thing about it. There's thermodynamics, statistical mechanics, there's astrophysics, there's quantum gravity, of course, quantum field theory in curved space-time, and there's now also quantum information. This all comes together in this evaporation of black holes, which is totally amazing. And that's why this phenomenon of the evaporation of black holes has attracted so much attention, because of this potential to combine these totally different research areas.
I feel that Stephen has been one of the most influential scientists of all time. This idea that black holes evaporate and that quantum fluctuations in gravity can do everything from evaporating black holes to creating ultimately the galaxies around us in space is something which it not only has revolutionized modern research, but it's also something which really dominates future research, because we know that it's probably true that black holes evaporate and you have these quantum fluctuations in space-time that give us ultimately the fluctuations that make the galaxies and so on, but we still haven't quite figured out how it really, really works. So Stephen is going to be guiding our research for years to come.
We live in a strange and wonderful universe. Its age, size, violence, and beauty require extraordinary imagination to appreciate. The place we humans hold within this vast cosmos can seem pretty insignificant.
Special thanks this week to Roger Penrose, Marika Taylor, Sabine Hossenfelder, and Max Tegmark. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Forget for a minute what you know, or think you know, about space. Then gaze upward at the night sky. What would you make of all those points of light? Are they tiny fires? It can be hard to imagine what they really are, for what they really are is far beyond your ordinary experience.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.